going to talk about today, thanks to the kindness of its founder, who is willing to visit with us, something called Couchsurfing. So with that, we're going to start a discussion with Dan Hoffert and get a little groundwork laid for how Couchsurfing began. I guess we should pull our audience. We can't do this easily with the webcast watchers, but for the people in this room, how many have used Couchsurfing.com before? So how many are using it right now in the sense of staying in Boston with a host? Excellent.
Oh, no.
You're just you're hosting people right now. Got it.
No,
not at this very moment. Last couple of days. That works for me. Great. Is there anybody here heard of Couchsurfing? Or is our audience, Professor Zinberg. So good. That gives us reason to do some exposition. Exactly. Focus group of one. So Dan, first tell us a little bit about your background. If we knew you as a teenager, what would we see?
Well, so my name is Daniel Hoffer. I'm founder and chairman of Couchsurfing. My background, as a teenager, I founded an online community. I am 31 years old, so as a teenager, I was working on a project on a bulletin board system back in the early 90s, and founded an online community that connected physically disabled patients, people with muscular dystrophy, with elementary and high school students online.
And this was, when you say online then, if this was early 1990s, this was not internet.
Yeah. This was internet, but this was pre-web.
Pre-web internet.
Yeah.
So how did they connect? They used Gopher or something?
Well, they dialed up to an online bulletin board system through modem.
Yes.
And there was an internet hookup using FidoNet.
FidoNet?
Yeah, I don't know.
Anybody remember FidoNet? Chris Segoyan, of course. FidoNet. That was where bulletin boards at individual phones could call each other on the phone in the dark of night and swap messages with one another.
Yeah.
And if you had a wrong number in the FidoNet list, it would just keep calling it. And if you had a human answering, saying, shut up already, I don't want your loud screeching noises.
Right. Yeah. It was a pretty crappy system. But it kind of worked. It worked just well enough to give you hope that it could work.
And what first got you into this?
I got into online stuff in elementary school. I was really bored. I grew up in Brooklyn.
Say no more.
Not a lot goes on in Brooklyn. More now, I think the town's got more exciting. But it was kind of a quiet little town.
So you turned to computers to ease the boredom.
Well, you know how you get the stereotypical 13-year-old, and in their real life, they're a 13-year-old, and online they're like master of the universe, or Dark Lord or something. So that was me.
Uh-huh.
So I had my whole alter identity online.
And how did that project turn out?
That was great. Because it was so early, it was kind of innovative. So
yes.
So it was publicized on the front page of the Globe, lined up a bunch of schools around.
It's really news perfect, isn't it?
Yeah.
Young teen helps the disabled using computers.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, so it was a good start. That was back in, 92. Just kind of...
Okay,
there.
So you go to college?
Yeah, so I went here.
Harvard College.
Harvard College.
You can hear the cheers if you're on the webcast. People are cheering wildly right now. And you majored in?
Philosophy.
Philosophy.
Yeah. Deep thoughts about unemployment.
Got it. And while you were in college, were you?
Yeah. So in college, I ran a software consulting firm out of my dorm room, partnered with local companies, Next Step Technologies, and other local firms.
I see Next Step is represented here today. Very good to see you. Yes, Mr. Chadafti.
Had a bunch of clients. And then started to leverage that towards founding .com, raised a couple million in venture capital. I was still a student at the time, so I took some time off.
And what was the .com called?
.com was called Fuxedo Worldwide. It was
easy to spell?
Yeah. Yes. It was based on some Spanish word, and it was a soccer website. So our target market was in Latin America. So we figured we'd use some Spanish words to reach the customers.
And how did that turn out?
It crashed, ultimately. raised a couple million.
When you first, it was Spanish soccer, you say?
Yeah, yeah.
When you got your first tranche of money, you'd be like, oh!
So actually we had Seamus Malin, who's the local MLS commentator. He was working for us. He was also affiliated with Harvard, actually.
Yeah.
And it was a lot of fun. I learned a lot, but at 22, I didn't really know anything about running a business.
Okay, so out of the ashes of that, what happens next?
Yeah, so then I hired a team for that company and ended up hiring the people who later became my co-founders for Couchsurfing. So my VP of technology and also usability, we became friends and we ended up co-founding Couchsurfing later.
When did you get the idea?
So the idea was, I had done a lot of adventure travel. But the idea was actually kind of also the genesis of my partner, Casey.
Define adventure travel for those who are not adventurous.
Yeah, so after college, I graduated, I spent a few months traveling through Southeast Asia, and I was, by myself and traveling through Bali and made friends with local people in Bali and ended up staying with them and at their homes and, staying up late and drinking beer and playing chess and just having a totally different experience than you would get if you stayed at a Marriott. So that kind of tuned me into, and I also done things like that in college. I took some time off. I wasn't the typical Harvard student. I went and worked on a ranch in Texas one semester in college. I had trouble getting through Harvard. Made it eventually, but two detours along the way. I worked on a ranch and couchsurfed there, which was also a very different experience. Just getting to see a different kind of person and people and culture.
So I guess it'd be helpful to define the term. What is it to couchsurf?
Yeah, so to couchsurf is, we've actually expanded, we tried to expand the definition of the term a little bit. in common parlance, it means to stay in someone's home and sleep on their couch.
Generally someone you don't know otherwise.
Well, I mean, traditionally it's been someone you do know. We've kind of expanded this to people you don't know. That's kind of the core value proposition. We also encourage couch surfing to be not just limited to staying on people's couches on an overnight basis, but also if you're traveling, you want to make friends somewhere. Maybe you already have a place to stay, but you just want to see the scene, you want to get to know local folks. Couch surfing, by our definition, still perfectly valid to reach out to people and meet up with them for a cup of coffee, go out for a beer or go to a nightclub with them or whatever.
So your initial conception for the site was what?
So I was inspired based on my successful experiences couchsurfing in Texas and in Bali and so on.
And the way you basically do that is you would meet people at a cafe or at a restaurant or something.
Yeah, just randomly.
You'd greet them, they'd greet you, and they'd say, where are you staying tonight? And you'd say, I'm glad you asked, because I got nothing.
Pretty much, yeah.
And then they'd think, why don't you stay with us?
Something like that, yeah.
And then you'd do something in exchange.
Yeah, so, in Bali, Bali is not a terribly wealthy area. It's part of Indonesia. I try to bring big bottles of beer for us to drink as we were staying up late. My contribution, and maybe a feast and so on, obviously think of a specific experience. But the idea for the website came from my partner, Casey, and he was taking a trip to Iceland, wanted a place to stay, was traveling on a budget, and ended up finding a mailing list of university students from Reykjavik. It's basically spamming, completely inappropriate.
He spammed Reykjavik?
Yeah. Okay.
Somebody says, what's the capital of Iceland? And the answer is about 2 kroner right now.
Sorry.
It's going to date the podcast.
Okay, 1 kroner. So he
spams a list inappropriately.
He sent out an email to the entire list of kind of 1,000 students, none of whom he knew, obviously, saying, hey, I'm an American coming to Iceland.
They said, we know.
Like, any chance I can stay with someone? And a bunch of people responded. They said, yeah, come stay with me. So he did. Had a great experience meeting some locals, staying with them, and from that, we decided, hey, we should institutionalize this. We should make it easy for other people to have the positive experiences with staying and spending time with locals that we've had.
So at that point, was this sort of a back burner project, or this was like, let's do it full time, we're going to build this site and roll it out?
Yeah, it started out as back burner. My partner was working on a political campaign, I was working as a management consultant, and so this was kind of back burner for both of us. And then my partner is a programmer, so the site certainly benefited from programming, because that's what it is. So he started to wean himself off of full-time work in order to dedicate more and more time to building the site.
And when you conceived of it, was it as a money-making proposition, or?
Yeah, so couchsurfing is a nonprofit, and it's something we've always got a lot of questions about. But the idea was, partially the idea was so that when we traveled, we could have more people to stay with and have fun with.
Do you block the Wayback Machine from couchsurfing.com? Say what?
You have a spider eye, possibly?
Well, the question is, it's funny that it has no, I was going to look for the old couchsurfing, the oldest possible homepage, but it looks like the Wayback Machine has been instructed not to. Anyway, we digress. Sorry, you were saying.
So couchsurfing is a nonprofit, and the idea was that, just from a personal, selfish level, we wanted more people to stay with when we were traveling, because it'd be more fun if you can find people everywhere. But we decided to open it up and enable other people to have great experiences, and money was not really the primary motive. So we made a nonprofit. We thought that would influence the feeling of the site, the culture, which I definitely think it has. To this day, we're still a nonprofit.
So how did you unveil it?
There it is. This is our new logo, by the way. It's funny, this is a small digression, but you always, running a business, there are always things you never think of. We just did this new logo up here, and then the people in Asia, our members in Asia, we have hundreds of thousands of members in Asia, we started getting this hate mail saying, why are you discriminating against Asia? We're important too, because you're not showing Asia in your logo.
This was the old logo?
No.
Oh.
No, that was one of the...
That's a competitor that's ripped off your name.
Yeah, no, that was one of the t-shirt designs.
I see.
I totally forgot the question. I got distracted by my name.
How did you unveil it?
How did we unveil it? Right. Yeah, so the go-to-market approach was we posted on... we basically did guerrilla marketing. We never paid for marketing at all of any kind. And we posted on tribe.net, which was a little more prominent 5 or 6 years ago than it is today. But basically, we just sent out emails to a bunch of news groups and Usenet and saying, hey, we've got this new site, check it out.
What did the adoption curve look like?
So actually, if you click more statistics, see the adoption curve. So go up and go to real regional stats. Scroll down. All the way to the bottom. Alright, there's the adoption curve. And then this is cumulative, and this is weekly. Every now and then there's a spike from some particularly prominent.
So there was a period of time, say from here to here, where you were just like waiting for the ship to come in.
Well, I mean, honestly, back in the day, we get something like 2,000 members every day now. When this started, we were so excited to get, 2 members. It was awesome. And I used to go and read every single new member coming in, look at their profile, and kind of learn about it. It was very exciting.
It's like Tom friending you on MySpace.
Yeah, exactly. So, I didn't friend friend everyone, but I definitely looked at the profiles, and, you know, it was, they call it customer research, but it was really just because I was excited someone was visiting the site. So it didn't feel like slow growth.
Got it.
I mean, also in part because we weren't backed by venture capitalists. We weren't, you know, performing to specific milestones or, you know, target metrics. This was completely bootstrapped, so it didn't really matter how fast it grew.
And the original functionality of the site was user registration, declare where you'd like to stay or declare where you are and who you'd like to host, and then a kind of almost an eBay-like engine that just puts the two together.
Pretty much. I mean, the core functionality hasn't changed a whole lot. The core is the same, and we've made things more robust. We've built out features. We've had to invest a lot in scalability of the site because we now get so much traffic. You know, so our technology team is always just, you know, dealing with the growing pains associated with the scalability and growth. So.
And when was your first sense, if ever, that simply arranging for people to get together and calling it a day, as far as the site was concerned, was not enough to keep the community thriving? And again, it might be a loaded question. Maybe that is enough.
I'm curious why you're saying it's not enough.
Well, I guess I've talked about couchsurfing to audiences which include almost no couchsurfers, and there's still plenty of those, as you might guess.
Yeah.
And when I describe it, I say it usually a little playfully as, at last, a site that connects people who want to sleep on a faraway stranger's couch for free with people who live far away and would like a stranger to sleep on their couch for free.
Oh, yeah?
And often, my sense is that when people hear about it, they say, well, geez, how many people have been robbed or hurt using couchsurfing? Kind of a classic Fox 25 News at 10 kind of question.
Sure.
Exactly the kind of phenomenon by which Fox 25 or other local news, don't mean to single out Fox, would lionize this as a really cool thing.
Right.
And then the minute there's a problem, just like we had the Craigslist killer,
right.
You know, you never call it the newspaper killer if somebody used a newspaper ad to get somebody, then suddenly it's, uh-oh, what are the dangers? So is there that moment where somebody says, or you're even looking, I had a bad experience, you wouldn't want this person to host or to surf on your couch again,
sure.
That you figure the system ought to somehow be responding to that?
Yeah, so, couchsurfing, so it's kind of a long and complex answer to that, so rein me in if I start talking too much. Couchsurfing is based on a mentality of idealism and faith in others, you know, so typically when I tell people about couchsurfing, the first, in many cases, the first reaction I get is, what an awesome idea. And the second reaction I get, which happens about 1 second later, is it safe? And especially from women. So safety is a top concern, and we're certainly very sensitive to it. You know, basically, we have facilitated approximately 2 million positive experiences through the site. And that's what attracts people. The media is a fickle animal. And, you know, one day they'll sing your praises and the next they'll turn on you. We've been fortunate that they have, by far, sung our praises much more than anything negative. But yeah, there is the concern. I mean, there have never been any murders through the site, thank God. You know, knock on wood, right? And that's a risk, you know, and we have, we have a whole PR team now because we actually receive a ton of media coverage. I've worked with my PR team helped put a plan in place for, you know, how do we deal with incidents like that? You know, how do we deal with if the press gets a hold of it? You know, everyone's looking for a story, you know, and if they hear about something juicy and someone gets hurt or killed or whatever, you know, they're going to love to broadcast that as loudly as they can because it's a good story. So we have a PR team that's now trained at dealing with that, and we've been practicing procedures and so on.
But all this stuff that you go on the site, when, as you say, question three on the fact is it safe?
Okay.
There's all now sort of extra features. When do these features come along that members can vouch for each other, that you can be designated an ambassador, or that you've been verified to different levels? That starts to sound 24-like.
Sure.
Maybe just explain these quickly, and then how do they come about,
yeah.
And when?
Yeah, so, you know, so we've thought, I mean, obviously, in any startup is a progression, right? You're always, and even if it's not a startup, you know, Coca-Cola and Pepsi iterate on their model every day. So we're always iterating on trying to figure out how to make everything more effective and more successful. So some of these things didn't exist initially. We have a number of systems in place to help address safety concerns and to make the site safer and to make the community safer. So one of those, if anyone has used eBay, you know, there's a seller reference system and people rate sellers, right? So we have a system like that. You rate the couches that you've stayed on, you write references, you actually write text about the people that you've stayed with.
And is this easily found or just want to have to log in to find out?
No, you can find any member. So if you go to the homepage and click on a photo of a member, just click show. Let's scroll down. There you go. So these are references. This person has a couple references. There you go. Charismatic and fun, and
good with people. Pets, no.
So, you know, this is the kind of thing people write about each other. They characterize their experience as positive, positive, neutral, or negative. We used to have extremely positive, neutral, negative, and extremely negative.
If anybody got rated short of extremely positive, they're like, what was wrong? What did I do?
Yeah, I mean, what I found interesting is some of the different ways culturally that people react to each other. So in Latin America, people tended to rate more positively overall, which is kind of interesting. And then, you know, other cultures, people were especially afraid to rate negative, kind of were a bit more sensitive about saving face and so on. So, you know, one of the things we've had to think about is what kind of system really captures this in a way that is universally understood, but also is not too granular in a way that's kind of confusing, or there's also the risk of people getting offended by, if someone gets rated positive instead of extremely positive, you know, you get your feelings hurt a little bit. extremely positive, I got to. Are we taking questions?
Sure. Chris.
So what you've described here essentially is a reputation system, yeah, similar to eBay, right? And one of the, I guess, the problems that eBay system has suffered from, first is that you can go on and basically transact with yourself and give yourself positive feedback. And go on.
Feedback farm. Yeah. Feedback farm. You and your five closest friends or alter egos. Right.
So I could create a bunch of fake accounts and give positive feedback to someone, and then you sell something for $10,000 and then never deliver the good, right? So you have the possibility of that, and then, you know, reputation networks in general only are as good as the cost of creating a new account, right? The minute you have any sort of negative feedback, you ditch that account and create a new one. But how have you mitigated those issues in your system?
Yeah, so you raise an excellent point, and that's a great segue into another one of our systems that we have in place and operational processes. So we also have an identity verification system, and that helps authenticate that people are who they say they are. So, you know, the risk is that I can create five accounts in Couchsurfing under five different names, and I can leave myself five different references, all extremely positive, and fool the world, right? So that's a risk. The way we partially mitigate that risk is through our identity verification system. What we do is we use credit card information and sometimes passport information to verify that the people live where they say they live. So we send a postcard with proprietary code to someone's address based on their credit card information, and then they need to punch that code in the website, and then we know that they live where they say they live. It's not foolproof. And ultimately, something we emphasize is that this system can be gamed. This is not perfect. You can't know for sure. So if anyone says, can you guarantee that Couchsurfing is safe? I say, absolutely not. There is no guarantee like that at all. That said, what we have works. Well over 99% of experience, like I said, 2 million positive experiences. One more experienced Couchsurfers, and it seems like we have a number of Couchsurfers in the room, which is great, I think become experienced at reading profiles and actually being able to, you know, they increase their ability to spot any potential issues. And it is possible to get a sense of someone from their profile and also based on comments. You know, if all the references have the same writing style or the same punctuation style or typos or whatever, you can start to get a sense of these things. And also by looking at the references themselves. You know, if I leave a reference for someone and then someone's checking that person out and they link back to my reference, they see I'm a founder, they say, oh, okay, well, you know, if Dan's providing reference, then that means he's Nathan, probably gonna be okay. You get to see people. You also, Couchsurfing also tracks kind of like LinkedIn, who you're connected to inside the site. So you can see which of your friends might know someone you're going to stay with, or how many layers away someone is. So there's no one system that makes it perfect, but in aggregate, we have multiple ways of addressing this challenge that combine and make the system work pretty well.
What percentage of the feedback left is negative?
So that's actually tracked. If you go on to, if you go back to the mission statistics page, go back to the homepage and click statistics.
Statistics.
Hold on. Hold on.
Sorry. Under about.
Or left. No, okay. Don't worry. Mission. Okay. So that's regional statistics. There's also mission statistics.
Uh-huh.
99.806%.
How big a customer service operation do you run? People sometimes contact you, somebody left a negative thing, and verklempt over it, how can I have it expunged, how can I tell my side of the story sort of thing?
Sure, yeah. I mean, I get the most ridiculous emails sometimes. I get these 3-page emails from random people in random countries, you know, saying, you know, my neighbor was on the site, and then, there was a girl, a dinner, and someone knocked over the candle, and then the curtain caught on fire, and all this stuff, and bottom line, they left me a reference, and my profile got deleted by the safety team or something, and can you please restore it, because clearly I deserve to be here. I get this all the time.
The answer to that is?
Yeah, the answer is no.
Okay, and there's a safety team.
There's a safety team.
Are they employed? Are they paid?
Yeah, so we have, one of our core really valuable teams is we have called the Member Dispute and Safety Team, MDST, and we have a woman named Rachel DiCerbo, leads that. She is a full-time employee of Couchsurfing. She's also recruited a volunteer staff to help her. Very selective in recruiting. It's a very delicate position. But basically, these complaints come in, you know, member disputes, and then the occasional safety issue comes up, and it all goes to her team. And they review it, and then depending on the situation, may or may not take action. And some of those actions, they do delete accounts in certain instances. Unfortunately, in very rare instances, there is something like a theft. And that unfortunately has happened. You know, like as you can see, 99.8%. It's extremely rare, but it has been known to happen. You know, like an iPod was stolen at one point, or something like that. And in that instance, we will work with the police, and we'll take our cues from the cops or the FBI or whatever to do whatever needs to be done.
What's your biggest worry about the site right now, about the project?
What I hope is we have this fantastic community right now. We a couple weeks ago we passed the 1 million member mark, which was a big milestone for us. Very exciting. And the thing is, you know, we're growing from a small town to a mid-sized town or a city, depending on how you look at it. There's a risk that the culture changes and you start to get the wrong sorts of people. So on the one hand, we want to open this up and make it more accessible and more available and more useful on a global scale. But on the other hand, we want to keep the right type of people involved, and we want to keep the special culture that we've had that has enabled us to grow as big as we are today. So basically growing in a way that's sustainable and positive.
So is it fair to say that Couchsurfing is something to which one apprentices? You kind of encounter the site and sign up, but there's a runway of sorts, a series of quests almost, if it were a video game, but ways that you sort of get to know the culture of the site as well as just the functionality. I guess people might mistakenly confuse it with something like Expedia or TripAdvisor, where it's just you go in and you get linked and go to a hotel kind of.
Well, your use of the word apprentice is interesting to me. Not surprising you're thinking of these terms given that you're a professor here. But one of the...
it's either a compliment or insult.
A compliment, of course. otherwise, I'd have to leave right now. one of the philosophies of Couchsurfing, it's a very egalitarian kind of mentality, and in each member profile, we have a field called Teach, Learn, Share. And the idea is that no matter who you are or where you're coming from, everyone has something to teach. Even if it's just their own interesting life story, a farmer in Cambodia, I guarantee you, will be better at growing rice than you. And you guys probably know a whole lot more about law than farmer in Cambodia, right? So, and I experienced this firsthand when I was living on a ranch in Texas. They had me do ranch work, and I was a Harvard undergrad. I didn't know squat about ranch work. I kind of sucked at it. But anyway, so teach, learn, share. Do you see it there?
I'm looking for it. I don't see it, actually, in this particular one.
Someone might not have filled it out in their profile, so just go to a different profile and you should see it. You can go to my profile if you want.
Well, I'm sure yours would have it.
Yeah. anyway, so the idea of apprenticeship, going back to Jonathan's word there, the idea is the teacher is the student, and vice versa. You're always learning from other people in the community, and we encourage that. And it's more of a, you're both the teacher, and you're the student, and you're sharing yourself, and your culture. So that's kind of the profiles on Squadron.
I haven't seen it yet, but still plenty going on.
Well, there are a million more members, so I'm sure it's...
question on the online tool. Have you thought about leveraging this to things like carpooling or other social interactions? It's funny that, I guess, if you want to share a ride, you go to Craigslist. Mm-hmm. It's a much thinner veneer.
Yeah. So we actually looked at the carpool market starting in 2002 or something. So we actually registered a domain back then. I don't even remember what it was. It's some ridesharing.com or one of some domain that sounded like that.
I can tell you one that's taken is carsurfing.com because I want to do it.
How was Zipcar?
Well, this is Zipcar.
This is Robin Chase, founder of Zipcar. Right.
Oh. Yeah. Real money.
Natural linkages here, yes.
So certainly there are some great potential there, kind of some obvious synergies.
It could be a bundle deal. You use a zip card to go to your Couchsurf, then it's bundle.
So I believe that Zipcar recently announced, an alliance around carpooling and ride sharing. It's something that we've looked at in the past. We ultimately decided we didn't have the resources to dedicate to it, and we wanted to focus on our core competence. Definitely seemed like an interesting adjacent market, but not something we have the resources to pursue.
And are you at the size where the, this is another online question, the hospitality industry, whether the hostel ends of things, or TEL, or the, nicer hotel sides of things, see you as a threat or something to which they have to respond in some way?
Bed and breakfast would be natural.
Beds and breakfast?
Yeah. Yeah. So if anyone's read The Innovator's Dilemma by an HBS professor, Kyle Christensen, we're kind of the upstart that catches the industry by surprise after it's too late for them to do anything about it. I think ultimately we're on the one hand, we're making a dent because we've facilitated roughly 2 million experiences that directly cannibalize sales of the hospitality industry. On the other hand, 2 million is really not that many in the scheme of the global hospitality industry, and it's, we're completely geographically dispersed, so I don't think we're hurting anyone too much right now. But I think what is interesting is we have helped create this market, and the market is expanding, and to the extent that we can change how people actually think about travel, that could represent a snowballing effect that would also extend to other, some of our competitors, frankly, as well, that in aggregate might start to have an impact on.
Because what you get from a hotel when you stay there is a fee for service. Often what they give you is privacy and isolation, not a social experience.
Right. So ultimately, there will always be a niche for hotels, or a niche for us, depending on how you look at it. But the thing is, for business travelers, for example, business travelers should not couchsurf, in my opinion. I've done my share of business travel at Fortune 500 companies, and it's just hard to develop the relationships with the host that we encourage, because you're too busy doing business.
Yeah, nice to meet you. What's your Wi-Fi key?
Yeah, exactly. You're there on business. You shouldn't have time. And we try to de-emphasize a transactional relationship. It's not about free accommodations. It's about developing relationships with people. So there will always be room for hotels will always have a place. I think we will always have a place. Bed and breakfast, as you noted, I think would be most likely to be potentially cannibalized by this, as well as youth hostels. And that's certainly already happening on the youth hostel side more than any other segment of the hospitality industry.
Questions?
But going back to your earlier statement about the future of the web and whatnot, which I kind of found interesting, the core value proposition, can you expand on that at all?
Of Couchsurfing?
In general, what is the core value proposition?
Of Couchsurfing.
Yeah, and I guess you can apply
applies to CoStar, yeah. Yeah, is that a term that you apply in marketing in general, or is that a term that is specific to CoStar?
I'm a business guy, so I yeah. talk in terms yeah. of value propositions, I guess.
Core value propositions, yeah, I'm sorry, I need to...
Yeah, so it, from a capturing perspective, I see the opportunity, the core value proposition to be being able to meet new people and develop relationships with people that you would not otherwise have the opportunity to meet.
I suppose another business type question would be revenue model?
Sure. Does that answer your question, or...?
No, but thank you.
Revenue model?
We can talk afterwards.
Yeah. Cool.
Revenue model. So we do not run advertisements. That's certainly, a lot of people assume we run advertisements. Even the press writes articles about us and talks about our advertisements. We don't run advertisements. So we charge for identity verifications, which is a process I described to you a bit earlier. As you know, it's not a foolproof process, but it is how we make money. It's optional. Members don't have to do it. Only roughly 10% of our members have actually gone through it. But we make enough from that we're actually profitable as an organization.
And that's technically a donation.
Depending how you look at it, yeah.
Well, how your website seems to look at it is donations including verifications.
Yeah, okay.
All right, so almost 800K.
Yeah, 800K.
Yeah.
So,
you know.
Are people donating without donating down to people donating
now? So I did the analysis a couple years ago. It was 83% verification revenue, 70% donation. I suspect it's even higher verification right now. So for the most part, people get verified and see that as their donation. In the same way that if you contribute to the World Wildlife Fund, you know, you want a little sticker of the whale or whatever, a polar bear or something, panda. So they donate to us and then they get verified, and that tends to be how it works. But if we were more financially motivated than we are, obviously there's a lot of things we could do. We could start running ads. We could raise our prices. There are a number of things we could do. We're in talks with Intel right now to do a sponsorship. We might do it. T-Mobile recently did a campaign about us, about Capture Fame. There's money out there. Right now, we're profitable as it is. We're doing pretty well, and so it hasn't been our primary concern.
Yes, sir. Couple questions. One, along the lines of competition, have you looked into getting into the market of, I don't know exactly what it's called, house swapping? And the other question would just be, have you tapped in at all into the slow travel movement?
Sure. So in terms of house swapping, CouchSurfing, you know, the core value proposition of CouchSurfing is facilitating relationships, and also, by extension, facilitating intercultural understanding. So house swapping doesn't really achieve that, because you don't meet. So that has not been as much interest. Slow travel is great. I mean, certainly a number of our members live it. I'm not sure what role exactly we would play in encouraging that, but we support it in principle.
Way in the back.
Just out of curiosity, in terms of the verification versus donation, is the percentage that people are donating higher than people are paying?
Percent? In many cases, our donations are of a higher average amount than what the comparable verification amount would be. The number crunching actually gets a little bit complicated because our average price, our prices change by country. It costs a different amount to get verified in the U.S. than it does in Thailand. And that's not because it costs us different, it actually costs us more to verify in Thailand. But $25 in the U.S. Is a lot cheaper than $25 in Thailand. So we thought a lot about what is the appropriate metric to adjust pricing on a globalized basis. The bottom line, yeah, donations do tend to be higher than average.
Working rightwards, sir, and then Roxy. Yeah.
Yeah, any question? Based on your revenue, we talked about your tech teams and your local teams, price teams, your safe teams, partly volunteer. You have volunteer contingent kind of running the company in a semi, like the open source model where other people from outside the company contribute because clearly you can't pay to anybody who's working.
That's a great question. So CouchSurfing is a really unusual organization in a lot of ways. One of the ways is we have approximately, I think we have 6 or 7 full-time employees, paid staff. We have about 1,500 volunteers who obviously do the vast majority of the actual work. And
is that developing for you and things?
Everything.
As well?
Everything. We have volunteer programmers. We have volunteer customer service reps. We deal with a massive amount of customer service inquiries and challenges. We have an entire PR team. No one on the PR team gets paid. The safety team, there's only one paid person on the safety team. CouchSurfing is really a volunteer-run and volunteer-driven organization, and we're grateful, you know, because our volunteers make it all possible. Without them, we couldn't exist the way we do. Now, what's interesting is the process of managing and motivating 1,500 volunteers on a global basis, because, in effect, we have many of the challenges of a multinational corporation without the resources that a multinational corporation has, and that exists on multiple levels.
Classify volunteers, you have fanatics versus
candidates. You know, you're dealing with cultural issues, you're dealing with language issues, you're dealing with people not having time, or saying they have time and then they don't, you know, basically all the volunteer issues that exist in any volunteer-driven organization compounded by the multinational element. It's a challenge, but it's also, our relative success at it has also been what has enabled CouchSurfing to be as successful as it is, because we have
local feet on the ground in every city and town around the world. And we also have a class of volunteer called ambassadors, which Jonathan mentioned earlier, and they are people with special, you know, powers or you know, special authority from the organization, and they are evangelists for the community and the brand in every city around the world.
It is interesting to compare Wikipedia, which some would draw a rough analogy to in the sense of people passionate about a project that has as its fuel good faith. Early on, divided itself into different language versions, and the rules of Wikipedia vary by language version, as do the administration and the volunteers. And here you're going for, I guess, a less federated system, still more of an ideal of couchsurfing that's the same in each place, even as it adjusts a little bit locally, like in the costs and such.
Yeah.
And I don't know, Mako, if it's fair to call on you, Benjamin Mako Hill, who's been deeply involved in free software movement and politics and organization. I don't know, as you hear Dan's description, what sparks it sets off in your mind about how it might or might not compare to free software architectures and projects? I know you weren't prepared to be cold called, but I'm sure you'll rise to the occasion.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it raises, there are a lot of interesting parallels, especially when it comes to issues of sort of volunteer management and questions of the nature of the organization and sort of like paid labor and how you're going to mix sort of paid labor and volunteer work. So I guess the questions in my mind are in particular on sort of how you do that. I mean, like, when you have resources, and one thing that I found in a lot of free software projects have done is it's often easier to get money in terms of, I mean, even if it's just a matter of letting people donate, than it is finding necessarily ways to pay. So then people can introduce problems and people become that person get paid money or die. And how do you balance that? Maybe I can respond to that.
Yeah, no, you're completely right. I mean, money is a big issue. It's very sensitive, and we deal with that with our volunteers. So one of the things that we have thought a lot about, my partner Casey is thinks a lot about Maslow's hierarchy of needs, and how can we meet the various needs of our volunteers. In order to avoid just throwing cash around, which, you know, meets some needs, but frankly, there are a lot of needs, you know, you can be very wealthy and not have your needs met. So some of the things that we've done to try to address that is, Couchsurfing has two offices. One is stationary, we have headquarters in Berkeley, California, and the other moves around the planet. It's a nomadic office, and it's a live workspace, it's called a collective. It's a live workspace, and it's very useful as a tool to help recruit volunteers because we do it in fun, exotic places. So we have an office in Costa Rica right now. We had an office for 6 months in a village in Thailand. And what we do is we recruit volunteers we want, and then instead of paying them lots of cash, we say, look, we'll pay for your room and board. Come live with us for free, do some work for couchsurfing, and have an adventure. And a lot of people go for that. We've had really good experiences with that model.
And Mako, would you recommend that at the top of the hierarchy there basically be a good, beneficent decision maker whose judgment is essentially unquestioned?
So, I mean, that's an interesting question. I know that there are a few people who create basically other projects that look a lot like couchsurfing, but I don't really disagree about some fundamental aspects of that, right? And this is something that's been an important, it's an important aspect of the free software community, both in terms of, there have been a number of times when projects have, you know, successfully, probably more often unsuccessfully, but certainly it's this idea of the threat of the fork, as in this, you know, you can have the beneficent dictator, but you also always have the opportunity.
The surfers can always go elsewhere.
You can always go elsewhere, right?
And it's like it's a splinter community.
So, I mean, I don't recall the names of these, but I bookmarked them when I saw them. There's like couch-surfing splinter groups, as far as I can tell. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that and how that sort of impacts the nature of the organization.
Are there rump couches?
rump couches.
Settees.
Right, yeah. No, you're right. So there have been, you know, we've worked with thousands of volunteers over the years. Every now and then you get a group that, for whatever reason, doesn't like the way we do things. And in a couple cases, a group of them actually gone off and formed their own basically competitor couchsurfing, which they think, you know, represents what the true ideals of hospitality sharing should be. None of them have gone very far, especially those splinters. I mean, we do have other competitors, so to speak, but the splinters have never been very successful.
And I don't know how easily or quickly you can do it, but how might the ideals differ? What's an ideal that could differ so much it would be worth splintering?
Yeah, well, so one group of programmers felt very strongly that all of couchsurfing's code should be open source. Do you know someone in the community?
Probably.
I bookmarked it.
The people
bookmarked
it, so someone's
yeah.
Someone said it, so yeah, probably. Yes.
Got it.
Oh,
that's fine.
Should
we just cruise around the top, Roxy?
Yeah, just moving from the operations side, which means the user community itself. Just for you and Cooper, whichever one has been most interesting. I know when you register for a profile, there's an optional, what's your ethnicity box? And there's this great discussion that's like, go over here if you want to talk about ethnicity, and the real reason for keeping the box is to have conversations about ethnicity, right? But that said, it also is probably part of the challenge dealing with ethnicity and gender and language barriers and all these sorts of demographic things about the user community. So just wondering if you could talk a little about those challenges and the growth of that over time.
Sure. No, you're right. I mean, the ethnicity question has fueled a lot of discussion, both internally within the management team and also internally among members of the base. And they're like, well, you know, why does my ethnicity matter? You know, am I different? Am I better? You know, aren't we all humans? You know, that kind of thing, right? So, you know, what we say is, first of all, couchsurfing is about enabling, about facilitating intercultural understanding, and about enabling people to discover each other's differences and appreciate them. Not disrespect them for it, but actually to respect them for those differences. So, you know, so enabling people to provide their ethnicity enables them to signal how they self-identify. Or, you know, there's no requirements on the ethnicity field. It's not a drop-down menu. It's a text box. So, you know, some people are very creative. Some people will say Earthling, you know, or you know, whatever, ape descendants, you know, that kind of thing. So people, or just even blank. People can answer it however they want. And if it leads to a discussion about ethnicity and what makes us all similar or different, then we encourage that. You know, we welcome that kind of interaction because we feel like discussions like that ultimately bring people closer together, which is what Couchsurfing is all about.
Do you have advice on this front, Roxy?
No, I guess I'm interested in a slightly different, in the actual, like, growth of the user community. And when, I mean, we've been kind of like, oh, it's a bigger problem for women to show up in other countries and travel. Okay, like, what's that about? And how is, I mean, you guys now are an institution, and what, how have you seen the presence of yourself as an institution influence thought about that? Or any of these other things about, like, oh, well, this kind of people in this kind of country, they'll stay with them. Maybe that's changed over time.
So, I'm sorry, are you asking that?
If you've seen, as a result of couchsurfing existing, fostering these relationships, having this very positive, idealistic vision, like, how do you have indicators on how you've influenced those relationships over time?
Sure. So one of the really interesting things, you know, in the nonprofit social enterprise world, one of the challenges is always effective benchmarking and tracking success. You know, in the for-profit world, you can track it on an array of financial metrics. In the nonprofit world, you're dealing with, you know, a third balance sheet or, you know, other ways to look at things. So it's actually one of the areas we want to do a better job of going forward. We actually want to be able to do more quantification of the progress we've had and the impact that we've had, and you know, understand the details of how it all works better. So that's a good question. Okay. The very patient gentleman in the back.
Hi, yes. There's $25 minimum for the GFR plan. Yeah. I was wondering if you knew of, like, the most generous donation that has ever been given by a single person? That track that kind of thing?
I haven't looked at numbers like that in a while. I mean, I think it's, I don't know, maybe $500 or so.
Okay. Roughly. And one other thing. When you were showing the revenue, said outside merchandise is only at $680 worth. So I bought one of the t-shirts. So you told me I own one of the only 30 t-shirts.
Makes you feel special, doesn't it? Or are you suggesting that he needs an audit of his numbers? I can't tell which. But if you're saying you bought more than 30 t-shirts, then that would be concerning. No, so actually, we've just been talking about that recently. We're actually going to do an overhaul of the e-commerce presence and update some of the merchandise and make it better. Bottom line, I think you're right. I think you do own a few t-shirts, which is awesome. And please tell your friends and have them buy more. But we actually don't get any, we sell that stuff at cost right now. We don't get any margin from the sales. So we've been thinking more about our e-commerce strategy and looking at, you know, selectively doing some strategic pricing things to drive sales of some goods and less so of others, but you know, use it as a profit center overall. But overall, yeah, I mean, the sales of merchandise are pretty low today.
How intrigued are you by the mobile space? The idea that I could just be wandering around Paris, yeah, and just say, boom, show me couchsurfers within 50 yards of me. I'm just at this bar and I'd like to chat with somebody.
Yeah, I like the mobile space. We haven't done anything with it, again, due to lack of resources. We've actually been approached by a couple of iPhone developers who said, hey, do you want me to create an iPhone app? And we're like, sure, go for it. We don't really have anything good quite yet. But yeah, it'd be great. I mean, there's a lot of them. The other thing is, you know, if you arrive late at a, you know, your plane gets diverted, train or whatever, you arrive at 11 p.m. at a train station in Frankfurt, you know, you don't know anyone, you don't have access to a laptop or a network or whatever, you know, if you can punch in someone and say, I need an emergency couch, because I'm here at this train station, I mean, that's a useful thing. So we like to have that.
But, the bat signal, you sometimes have the couch signal. Yeah.
To expand the functionality, the trend was for the house swap, or an earlier term is general vacation exchange. And there in advance, you can check with other people listed. And there were subgroups, and there was private teacher subgroups, etc. And the other one is about use of schools. So there's lessons to be learned in terms of allowing for both ends. The mobile thing is like more of a media thing. And actually, there's a mix, because when I lived just by traveling, I would check with who was open for, not just Swappy. It wasn't Swappy. It was if they were there in town, they might have a couch. So this has been going on for a while. And then usually they would meet with a trusted friend, you know, person in a cafe, and they would use, you know, that hour or whatever and know whether or not they're trustworthy, but they previously have checked. And that leads me to the school possibility. Has anybody allowed for the less volatile, or, well, having basically the Brooklyn West End out, but it was at MIT. The next big thing, now that bank fraud is harder, is credit card fraud. And it is going to be fast, and the number of hours is only 12, what was quoted last week, in terms of what action you can take. And yeah, a lot of people check their email, like, a lot of times, and they're paying for this alert SMS or whatever, in case there's unusual activity. But if it's only a $30 spread across a million customers, which, you know, machines can do, that is definitely the next mushrooming and very, very looming target. So having relying on your credit card as verification, can you expand that, perhaps, to look for a little bit more variety, like maybe affiliation, like
level 10 on the on the scale. Thank you. We've got it. Over to you.
So regarding schools, I mean, ultimately, CouchSurfing's mission is to connect people and facilitate intercultural understanding and so on. So you know, there is a possibility to target exchange programs, student exchange, things like that. But we target, you know, 18 and up for the most part. So, you know, that would probably be a great, yeah, college enough. So, you know, we're open to working with schools. So we haven't done any special outreach to them, or have we built infrastructure around that. Credit card fraud is always a problem. Fortunately, we're mostly shielded from some of that by, you know, based on our credit card processing systems.
Now, of course, when you think about the legal interface to this, it's one of these phenomena that's so difficult to classify. You were telling me before we started that you can't even get your 501c3 status ironed out as a federal U.S. nonprofit because the IRS just, you're not a church, you're not a cult, you're not a scientific society, et cetera, et cetera.
You might be a cult, actually.
You might be a cult, yeah. That can help you, it turns out. Where was I going with all that? It's easy for phenomena like this to kind of fly below the radar. You're like the Segway, where they just don't know if you're on the sidewalk or on the, you know, what do you do? But there could be some tipping point where you can see the attorneys general worrying about some of the safety issues or kids, or you could see someone through the civil tort system threatening or saying, hey, I had a bad experience and I want some of your some of your balance sheet. Have you encountered any of that? And I guess for those among us who are law students or legal academics, it's worth thinking about how some of the intermediary liability structures and cases we know of would treat a phenomenon like this. And I think, you know, without having to send a bill, the answer is unclear. Even after sending the bill, the answer would be unclear.
That reminds me. CouchSurfing needs volunteer lawyers. and legal assistance in general. So even if you haven't passed the bar, but you could help prepare materials that our lawyer could sign off on, we would love to hear from you. IP, patent, trademark.
Well, right now, legal education kind of is in stealth mode. People write essay answers and exams, but it goes nowhere. It's just sort of like your stealth account. So actually having it matter could be a good deal. Chris?
So I first used CouchSurfing when visiting expensive countries, right? So I purely out of financial need, right? Like, I couldn't afford a hotel room, and I hate sleeping in dormitories and hostels.
Yes.
And this Christmas, when visiting Malaysia, I used CouchSurfing for the first time in a cheaper country where I can afford a hotel room.
Yeah.
And in that case, I didn't sleep on the person's couch, but I actually just went out and had dinner with them. And it was a really, really awesome experience. But I found out there that, like, there's an entire CouchSurfing community where people don't sleep on, they accept people from other countries to sleep on the sofas, but really, like, the CouchSurfers in Kuala Lumpur, they get together every month or two and have beer and chat over dinner. And I'm wondering if you can talk about sort of the growth of this as just purely, like, a way for people to find other like-minded
individuals. Well, this gets back to the broader definition.
Who live in their town.
Yeah.
Right? They, like, it's just another form of a meetup.
Yeah. So CouchSurfing has transformed into a thriving social community, even to some extent independent of actual travel. In New York, they have a weekly meeting of New York CouchSurfers that attracts, I've heard, approximately 80 people every single week. And you know, it's not about travel, it's just hanging out, having beers, and, you know, meeting other, as you say, like-minded people. So yeah, I mean, there are thriving social community everywhere. We had a party a couple weeks ago in San Francisco celebrating a million members. We had about 300 people show up. So yeah, it's definitely, you know, goes from online to offline.
And it's kind of an interesting phenomenon where you don't know that your identity is that of a CouchSurfer until you've done it. It's not an independent identity so much.
Until you buy a t-shirt.
Yeah, until you buy the t-shirt, yeah.
Actually, CouchSurfing meet up every Wednesday night in Boston, too.
Yeah, it's right. Right.
What's it like? Where is it?
I'm not sure. I can't.
It's at the other side cafe on Newbury Street.
Awesome. Elijah will visit. He's the first CouchSurfer. Really, think about it.
I'd love to go. It's a Jewish holiday. It's my Passover. I would come otherwise. But
it does feel like it's one of these things where, just as the Obama campaign, much to its advantage, got people to use their cell phones during the rally to dial the number of one person and make that pitch. And once you've done it, suddenly, now you are part of the campaign, it's easier to make the next 15. Here, I imagine, once you've done that first experience and get the good feedback, you're like, hey, I am a CouchSurfer. I'm going to go to the meetup, et cetera, et cetera. Robin?
So, this question of how to keep like-minded people together as you grow, it is an interesting question. How are you doing that?
So, the way I see it is one of CouchSurfing's greatest assets is our volunteer network of roughly 1,500 ambassadors around the world. These are people who have actually applied to work for free for CouchSurfing. They are, you know, hardcore evangelists of how they really believe in the institution. I believe that they have a very important role in evangelizing locally and recruiting the right people and kind of keeping the wrong people out. It's always possible to sign.
Once you got to the website, whichever way you got there, is there any formal mechanism? Or it's just like these are people as you said?
The CouchSurfing oath or quiz.
I see, you know, Craigslist, that was the initial idea, and now, of course, murderers are on Craigslist. So, you know,
No, I mean, you know, what's tempting is to put everyone through a training course.
Yeah. And then sign your
we're doing that with the masters, with ordinary members, you know. We also have, again, of our 1,500 volunteers, everyone, hopefully everyone here who's a cat surfer received a welcome email. Did you guys receive a welcome email from someone? Okay. So, the idea is that everyone gets a welcome email that's supposed to kind of set the tone for the culture, and you can always disregard it. You know, you can always say, you know, I know that's how it is, and I don't care. I'm just going to use the system for my own good. You can delete your own account, yeah. We've run periodic kind of customer surveys, which have come back overwhelmingly positive. If you consider something like a net promoter score, we score very well on that. Of course, there are... we can also track that. Right? I mean, we had a survey pop up as soon as someone logs in, with just like three or four questions.
So one question would be the degree of churn. How many people you lose on the one end as you're getting people...
Yeah, I mean, we have a... I don't know the numbers offhand, but a large percent of our members are active members by our definition. Over half. Logged in within the last 3 months.
And I suppose, too, a crucial part of the strategy could be keeping it low profile and low key, not advertising, not drawing people in until they discover it.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting balance because, on the one hand, we want to grow, we want more people because that enables us to achieve our mission of facilitating intercultural understanding and relationships and so on. On the other hand, we don't want to grow too much, especially if it's the wrong kind of people. So it's not bodies for the sake of bodies, it's, you know, it's right minded bodies.
Just say it, Rusty.
Just scroll it so I can see ages.
Oh, you just wanted to see ages. I couldn't tell if... Yeah, something...
No, you have to scroll to the right.
Oh, to the right. That's why you kept... Got it. Sorry. Everybody was leaning that way. What's going on? So, how are we on time, MR? We have to go because there's classes shifting around. So there's some class surfing about to happen. So this has been a fabulous hour. It's such an just amazing phenomenon, a really interesting one, one that no doubt will face a share of challenges precisely because of its success, including some of the cultural issues that are in flux right now that have occupied us for the last few minutes of conversation. Certainly, if I were your parents and hearing this and knowing your success, I'd be beaming in the corner of the room. Oh, wait a minute. There are your parents beaming in the corner of the room. But we're so pleased you had a chance to stop in and chat with us and really share this with us. We are proud of you, too. Thank you very much. And I guess if this room is needed, maybe there's a chance to chat in the little lobby area out there if there's time, if people have questions and such.